listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Carulla. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have our very first opera singer as a guest, Mrs. Renee Tatum.
Hello.
Hashtag Schneider. Awesome. I'm just kidding. You're like, no Schneider, just Renee Tatum.
No hyphen Schneider, but for professional purposes, Renee Tatum.
I like it. And tell Phil, your husband, I'm going to start calling him hyphen Schneider as his new nickname.
Well, he's been called Mr. Tatum on occasion.
Awesome.
I don't know about that.
Oh, I like it. See, you guys are a good match. You're like two peas in a pod. You know how to heckle each other in all the right ways. So, Renee, you have been singing opera at the Metropolitan, all over Florida, doing Mozart, Madame Butterfly, all kinds of amazing roles. Tell me where you started. Where did this love of opera come from? What was the moment of zen that made you want to be an opera singer?
I don't know about the moment of zen. It's been a wild ride. I'm a native Californian.
Woohoo!
SoCal. And I grew up in the community theater, which I think a lot of us, including you.
That's right.
Also had this wonderful experience with professional children's choirs and community theater. So performance opportunities. And I think we have a wealth of opportunities in that part of the state. And it seems to turn out some pretty serious musicians, opera singers and rock singers and theater, Broadway performers, and various types of music. So that's how I got started. Musical theater,
What was the first role that you did? What was the first production you did in high school or anything?
I think the first musical I remember doing was at the Moonlight Amphitheater in Vista, California. I did Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, but I was not Cinderella.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right.
I was one of the singing mice.
That's awesome. But see how far you've come. Your story is very Cinderella because look, you started out as one of the mice and here you are.
Look at where I am now.
That's right. So you started out as one of the mice and whoever that teacher was really must have just did not understand the talent that he had. But tell me what that whole process was like. Was it a huge ensemble? Was it a small cast? Like, how did it work?
I remember, just being in awe and just thinking, this is what I want to do all the time, And I had a dance teacher. I danced for quite a few years, too. I consider myself to be a triple threat. That is not accurate.
That's awesome.
I did a Christmas concert for my dance troupe in Carlsbad, which is also in Southern California. And they asked me to do a solo along with some other dancers. And I thought, oh, that'll be fun. And the concert ends and we do our routine. And the dance teacher said, I think you should really consider pursuing singing.
What?
Yeah.
That's not even like a good thing for a teacher to say. Come on.
It was said very nicely, but I remember thinking, but what she's actually saying is you have no chance of dancing professionally at all.
Were you doing like tap, modern? Like what were you doing?
Tap and jazz. And, I knew that, I was just never really going to do that. I was never going to be on Broadway as a dancer. It was not going to happen. Mostly because I enjoy eating.
Right. Well, me too. Another thing that we're connected to besides music. I love it.
And that and a professional dancer, I would have to just be literally watching every calorie for decades. And that's just not, Well, fortunately for opera singers, that's not a problem.
Yes, it's true. Well, but it is though. I mean, all of it, you know, you are the instrument. You have to be like health conscious. Yes. But did you start learning classical music in high school? Like, when was the direction kind of more focused towards classical music?
In high school, late high school, I started studying privately with someone that just really taught classical singers. So I started learning arias, art songs, and I just really had the natural inclination for classical singing. I really was never a belter, and I don't know if your audience is familiar with that term, but it was just never something that I could naturally do. And I tried.
Right.
But right. I just think that some voices are very much meant for certain styles of music inherently. And you just kind of hopefully go towards that. So I did that, and I pursued a vocal performance degree after high school. I went to Cal State Fullerton in Orange County.
Nice.
Go Titans. Even though there's no football team, but there's quite a good baseball team. So,
all right, that counts. Yeah.
And mostly I stayed close to home because I was adopted by my grandparents, and they were getting along in years and really wanted me to be close enough to drive home on the weekends. And so the program at Cal State Fullerton, I did some research, you know, Chapman, Fullerton, various schools, but it was actually, it's still to this day, a very strong program, a lot of opportunities. And I don't think I could have chosen a better undergraduate institution for, you know, my journey.
Well, also too, you kind of probably got a little bit more of a college experience than a lot of music conservatories. That's what Phil and I used to talk about at USC. It's like, man, it's so great that it's not a conservatory because you get to have that college life because you'll never get that back, you know, that time.
That's so true. You know, I feel that you can explore other, you know, disciplines. You meet people that don't do what you do, which I think is always a good thing. You're not in your little bubble. Yep. And ultimately, you know, a lot of people that pursue music end up doing something else. But if you feel that it's either this or nothing, you have that pressure. I mean, I think that can be a really real challenge, actually, as an 18-year-old. So, yeah, it was great. Had a great time. Great.
Were you learning a lot of like the 24 Italian art song books, or were you jumping into arias? Like, did you have a teacher that knew you were a mezzo versus a soprano right away? Or did you kind of have a transition? Tell me what a little bit of that was like.
So I had a really great teacher, Dr. Andrew Parks, who went to Juilliard, went to Eastman, went to, I think, Occidental. He was a native Californian as well, came back to California. So he had already kind of done the thing and knew the thing. And an East Coast mentality, East Coast trained, came back to Southern California. And I was able to just really get that information and that, you know, a mentorship from a very early age. So he kind of got me into arias, and he really trained me as release your voice, you know, just sing. So there really wasn't so specific technical training as I got later. But right. In some ways, as an 18-year-old, as a 20-year-old, you want somebody that encourages you to just sing without right. Holding back or without, you know, I think just allowing your voice to be what it is at that age, I think is really important.
And I think also it's like you're growing, like you're yeah. literally, your physical shape is growing. So, you know, there's a genetic part of it where he probably knew there's no need in pushing any of that until you just keep on developing as a person and spiritually, vocally, everything, physically, all of it's, you know, kind of tied in. So it was kind of awesome that he saw that right away, because a lot of teachers, they don't have that same approach. They're like, this is the technique I was taught. This is what you're going to learn. And this is how it should go. You're going to sing repertoire that's beyond your years.
Yes.
Start now, you know?
And I think that stifles a lot of young singers, and they start to hate pursuing classical music because there's these kind of limits to what, you know, you're going to be in this box and this is what you're going to do for 4 years. I'm like, well, what if I want to do this over here? So right. Yes. And also I had a really great friend who to this day, a dear friend of mine, who was getting his second undergrad. He came back to school. So he was a few years older than me. But he was he was an assistant for the big university singers. And he and I, you know, two peas in a pod, he introduced me to opera. He was steeped in it from a young age. His dad, you know, from Italy, the whole thing. He used to say, let's go to, you know, LA Opera, let's go see these shows, let's go to da 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 da. And that got me kind of in the scene and really starting to listen and understand what that professional world was like and the exposure to those people. You know, and I started to sing with Opera Pacific and I started to sing small roles with them and while I was an undergrad.
That's so awesome.
So many opportunities for someone that's, you know, precocious, that has a lot of talent, that's smart, and also not that I'm any of those things, but
no, but you, I mean, you were hustling too.
Like, I was hustling. I mean,
that's crazy. Yeah. The hustle never
stops.
Isn't that, you know, I want it to stop, but I also feel like when it stops, I'll just be old. You know, it's like, I'll just be like, I'm giving up the hustle. It's all over now, you know? So yeah, the hustle is definitely always, always going.
Yeah. It never ends.
So you were learning roles outside of school. Did you have to do recitals and stuff? Like we had to do, I think we had to do juries every semester, like six songs, something like that. Six pieces. Did you have to do that in addition to learning roles? Oh, my
God. Juries, roles, outside and stuff, outside engagements. It was a lot.
What did you, let me ask you, this is a vocal arts major to vocal arts major. What did you not like about your curriculum? Because I hated music history. I just did not love music history. I remember we had to study Gregorian chant for like 4 months. Yeah. And like we had them on tapes and they would just drop the Gregorian chant in the middle of the tape and be like, all right, write an essay on this Gregorian chant. And it was like, are you kidding me? At 8 a.m. It was like, so tell me from your experience, what curriculum, what part of it did you really not like? And what are the things that you did resonate with?
I have two experiences as an undergraduate that could have broken me or essentially changed my major. One of them was I had a piano instructor who was real old school.
Right.
And she was very serious. And I remember one day she said to me, Renee, if you don't learn how to play the piano, you are going to fail and you are never going to be a professional singer.
Wow.
But, that's harsh. You know, she just wanted me to try, just put in 5%, you know. Right. And as a singer, we were all completely like, I just have to play basic chords and scales. I'm not interested in a Bach.
Right, right.
I'm not interested in a cantata.
Especially, I'm sure you saw some of the piano students. You're like, that's not going to be me ever when they're just sitting there for 6-7 hours playing the same piece. No way.
I'm going to be around other people.
Yes.
My other thing was I had a theory professor who I adored, but I used to cry in theory because I'm going to let everyone in on a little secret.
Oh, I love this.
You know, at this point in my life, after 3 degrees, a career, you know, doing some academic teaching also in addition to singing, my musicianship skills are pretty high now. But right. When I started college, I barely knew what the circle of fifths was.
Right, right.
So when you have a singer at 18 saying, you know, what's 5 of 5? What's a secondary dominant? What's a flat 2? And how does that function? What
right.
is that, you know? And I'm like, what are you talking about? What is a dominant?
You're like, excuse me, I want to ask a basic question. And also, it was at 8 a.m. Let's talk about this.
Always.
Like, who made this musician schedule start at 8 a.m? Because I don't know any musician schedules that start at 8 a.m. So that's another factor. It's like they made their schedule all wrong.
No, I remember, I mean, I got emotional. I remember taking this test and thinking, what? This is math. I'm going to have to do something else.
Yes.
But it worked out because I worked so hard just to pass those classes.
You know what's really funny? I had a music theory teacher, and his name was Dr. Naidu. He was a hardballer about theory. I don't know if Phil ever had him, but he had it out for me. Like I would fall asleep in class. He would like slam the book on the table and try to embarrass me with questions and knowing that I was sleeping through the lesson so I didn't know the answer. So actually, Phil and I had an ear training teacher that loved us. Her name was Veronica Krausis. She actually lives down the street from me now. But she loved Phil and I so much because our ear training was great. We could hear things that most students weren't able to hear.
Right.
So she pulled me aside and she's like, listen, Dr. Naidu, he's got your number and he's like ripping about you in the teacher's lounge. I want you to meet with me and I'm going to tutor you in the afternoon hours and I'm going to help you ace his class. So she tutored me for free, which was amazing. And she would meet with me every afternoon or twice a week, something like that. And I would still fall asleep in class because it was 8 a.m. But when he'd slam the book and ask me a question, I knew the answer. I'd be like, and I would say that I'd be like, minor third. And I'd just go right back to sleep. And he'd be like, oh my God, he's going to pass. And I it was like the best revenge. But yeah, honestly, music theory is cruel, especially to singers. Cause like, we don't think about music like that because we're not thinking about intervals when the instrument's inside us. Right? You know what I mean? That's definitely something that you have to adapt to. And I think it's a little unfair because we don't think about music in the same way. So I feel your pain. Yes. I love that you were so vocal about that because music majors, we don't talk about that, especially opera singers. Mm-mm. Nobody ever talks about how jive some of the courses that we take are.
Yeah.
But I assume you got to your junior recital and this was like, okay, you're about to lift off.
Yes. Tell me
what those experiences were like and how that helped you shape the next level of your career.
So yeah, I mean, things just progressed really quite nicely. I had a lot of opportunities in the choirs, and we toured with the Boston Pops, Boston Symphony, and I got to sing with Pacific Chorale. Everything just kind of worked out for me, a ton of opportunities. And then of course, you know, I was ready to go leave California, and my teacher really advised me, you have to leave California. You have to go. You know, I was thinking about doing a master's at USC or, you know, UCLA, which I, you know, also got in. I, you know, was thinking I'll just stay here. He's like, you got to get out. If you're serious, you have to go away. You can always come back.
Right.
Go away. So I ended up going to New York and did my master's at the Manhattan School of Music.
Awesome.
Specifically for a teacher that I had met and had done a couple trial lessons with, but mostly because she was at Juilliard and Manhattan School. And
she was the head of the department, right? What was her name?
She was the chair. Mm-hmm. Cynthia Hoffman. Mm-hmm.
Cynthia Hoffman, that's right. I was going to say Deborah Hoffman, but
yeah,
she was our school advisor.
She used to come out to California. She had a relationship, I think. She used to do master classes. I remember watching a master class of hers. And she, you know, I think maybe it was a great recruitment tool, but she was also just a really fine teacher, at least for a while for me. So went to New York. That was my next step.
You studied with her privately for the both years or?
I studied with her. And then, I then went to Juilliard after that and did a year of an artist diploma in the Opera Center. So at the time it was the Juilliard Opera Center. And now it's the ADOS, which is Artist Diploma Opera Studies. So that's changed somewhat.
Did you see a difference between Manhattan and Juilliard or? I mean, obviously, East Coast and West Coast were probably very different, but between those two schools, was it pretty comparable?
Very comparable. I can say this because I've been to both schools. I think at the time, I think that this still remains true. I think there are actually higher level singers at Manhattan School. But that's probably based on sheer numbers. There are more singers at Manhattan School of Music. But I find there to be more operatic talent at Manhattan School, the possibility of, you know, large scale repertoire, just they need time. There's just more interesting voice that could develop in a way that I feel that Juilliard is what they're looking for. I mean, it's kind of a different thing. There are some amazing operatic talents, but I find that they cultivate a lot more of the art song singer.
Right.
And
that's interesting.
It's particularly in the master's program. I'm not speaking for the postmasters, which is what I did there. And that really is catered towards opera, getting out there, doing the thing. But if I'm just sheerly comparing the master's programs, I feel the Manhattan has more of an operatic bent.
Right.
And Juilliard is more art song.
Bard Suvercrop was my teacher in college and he had connections to Juilliard. So I actually went and checked out the schools and met some of the professors. And when I was talking to some of the students, it was a little tunnel vision. It was like a more extreme version of what I was dealing with at USC that I didn't like.
Yes.
And when I kind of got that vibe, it was like, this doesn't have as much freedom as a music school should have on some levels. Mm-hmm. Where I never went to Manhattan School of Music, but everybody said that Manhattan School of Music was like the freedom version of Juilliard. Like it was,
oh, I like that.
It was like a lot more creative, a lot more, it wasn't as strict and tunnel vision. It was a lot more like encouraging to kind of like diversify and whatever you wanted to do. And I was like, that always sounded like such a cool way to go. But USC didn't transfer their credits. So it was like, it would be like me going there for a year and then just never getting any of those credits back. So I was just like, let me just come back to LA and finish school. I want to get out.
You know? Yeah, that's smart.
You know that feeling where you're like, I just want to get out. So yeah. Did you, when you were in New York, were you doing any auditions or anything like that? Like meeting with agents? Were you doing any of the networking that you kind of can take advantage of because you're in the city?
Yeah, I was. And, you know, ultimately you don't realize this, but you're being watched, you know, right. As a singer in either of those. Now there's two other institutions in New York, but I don't actually really consider them because I didn't have any exposure experience with Manna's. And the Brooklyn School. So I really consider MSM and Juilliard to be
those are the two.
So people are watching you, they're scouting you, they're seeing how things go, you know, as you develop, seeing how you, you know, how your first year master versus second year master's, if you're making progress, if you have the potential. So I did some summer programs. I got into Chautauqua Opera, a program in Europe. And I started to kind of do that. I started to sing for the National Counts auditions through the Met. And I placed a few times, got to the regional finals. So people started to, you know that I was there. You know, they would come to see our performances at the conservatory. So, you know, a lot was happening when I was in Manhattan School. I got some pretty big awards from different foundations as a graduate. And then when I went to Juilliard, it's like the New York Times fishbowl, you know, you are on display for the artistic community to judge, essentially. Right. Is this person have what it takes? Is this person, you know, career potential? So the pressure is real. It's not made up. It's real.
And you have to wear the face like everything's cool, like a bear in a pool. Did you ever see Phil at any of these competitions? Because you guys were doing them. I don't know if you were doing them at the same time. He may have done them a couple years before.
I think a couple years before me, but I never met Phil, which I think is so funny that we never crossed paths because it seems like it's a big world, like the classical music world. It's actually not. It's so small.
Right.
You kind of just know who's doing the thing and especially, you know, your peers. But I remember distinctly seeing a picture of him on some summer festival site and thinking that guy looks like somebody that I'd like to get to know.
Oh, that's nice.
And he told me if we had met when I was younger and he was, you know, in college or we were in a program together, that he never would have dated me because I wouldn't have gotten his
name. I think it's the other way around, but you know what? It's all right. Let him tell you that for control.
I mean, that's the story he tells me. That's the story he tells himself.
That's funny. Well, you know what? It's like, what's really interesting is you guys were doing the same circuits, probably different years and mm-hmm. did cross paths mm-hmm. and you ended up together anyways, which is just awesome. And
yeah.
You know, your wedding was awesome, as we know. But let's get back to the music.
Yeah.
So when you're doing these, like, you know, young artist programs, like, did you kind of have an idea, like, okay, there's a certain city or a certain program that I'm more interested in than others? Because they're all, like, usually during the summer. They're kind of grooming you to get into their production companies.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most strategic program for you to jump into? Or what was that whole experience like for you?
So I did Chautauqua twice, and then I got into Marilla, which is the San Francisco Opera summer program, and that was pretty much the game changer for me. I'd gotten into Glimmerglass and Marilla, went to Marilla, and that's the feeding program. They take like four singers, maybe three out of the 28 that they take out of 1,000. To get into the Adler Fellowship at San Francisco Opera, which is the year-long residency. Wow. So I was also in the finals of Chicago the first year at Juilliard. I was in the finals for Houston. I was in the finals for a few other things. And I got into this, they called me up after the program's over in the fall, and I was in my second year at Juilliard, and they said, we'd like to offer you a spot. So I knew, I was like, well, I don't really want to be in school anymore. I need to do a thing. So that was my entry into the major residency program. So I left New York and went back to California, but now in the Bay Area.
Yeah, NorCal. And did they give you roles first? Did they give you a couple?
They gave me, I think I had four or five roles the year I was there. A lot of opportunities, recitals, various things, a lot of exposure. And of course, all of these managers are watching you. You're really on display. So that was a huge career, you know, boost for me. But I still had my sights on, I had been in New York. I'd been groomed and cultivated in New York.
Right.
And to go back to California, it was kind of a jolting experience because I'm so used to the energy of New York, which is insane.
Right. Right.
And it's like this, it's this mecca really. And California has its own thing, but California can feel really slow.
Oh, it's way slower.
And,
way slower than New York or even the East Coast, but especially New York. It's like,
and I miss that actually sometimes. I think to myself, why do I need to keep this frenetic pace? Even when I'm in another state, I'm in another state right now. I am moving at New Yorker pace with my black and my attitude, right?
Right.
So California, well, you know, I don't really have any complaints about the program other than I had these expectations and it wasn't exactly what I had come to expect. So the reality of it was not aligned with that. And New York came calling and I went back to your role while I was in San Francisco.
That's awesome.
And they had said, you know, the Met has always been interested in you. Would you like to sing for now deceased music director and do the program at the Met, which is the Young Artist program at the Met?
That's amazing. That's amazing. Let's be honest, let's tell every listener, this is probably the most sought after young artist program, I would say, in the country. Wouldn't you? I would say so.
That's the rumor. Yes. I mean, it's pretty prestigious. It has a lot of funding and you know, that's the gold. Like you really, as a young singer, that's Mecca, right? That's what you believe it to be. So yes. So that opportunity presented itself and I only stayed in San Francisco for a year and I went back to New York and did that program.
And were you doing the same kind of roles or I assume they had different productions going or did they?
Some of the same, like, you know, sometimes the Met is a weird place in that they like for you to have done roles somewhere else before you do them there. And that's, I don't know if that's the same kind of belief in other disciplines and other genres of music, but it gives them confidence, right? That you're not going to completely fall off the rails.
Right.
So for me, I did double a couple of roles my first year from San Francisco and then progress into other larger roles. And I did 3 years there and I'm going to use the word, I survived that program.
Right.
Take that in any way I mean it, good or bad, but I can only use the word survive.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's play one of the links that you sent us.
Sure.
What do you want to play us first to showcase what you do?
Why don't we do The Barber?
Okay. And what's the name of it? I don't have it on my email.
That's okay. This is Barber's piece, Sure on the Shining Night, from A Nun Takes the Veil, with its four songs in that set. And the poet is James Agee, a Knoxville native. And it's just stunningly beautiful, simple. It's been set by choirs. I sang this in high school.
Very cool.
I believe, or maybe undergrad with the choir.
Here's Renee Tatum.
Thank you.
Brava, brava. Very nice. Very nice. Beautiful. You took me back to all the college like recital pieces. You know, it's like people choose certain pieces that just have a vibe. And that one has a vibe. It's just beautiful. Just beautiful. Thanks. Tell me what drew you to that piece, why you love it, and what made you want to sing it to just feel right, and what it was expressing. Tell me all the things that you love about it.
Well, I remember this piece. I sang it, you know, when I was a lot younger, and it's deceptively impossible to sing well.
Well, it's the breath control. The breath control is crazy. Your phrasing was awesome, but like, man, your breath control, that you got to have some serious breath control.
That's it. And when you're a young singer, you just get through and you're like, I can't master this. I don't feel rewarded by singing this because it's just too challenging. And so then you keep revisiting things when you get older. And one day,
right,
you know, you're able to do the things you've always wanted to do. So,
you know, one thing I love about classical music and opera, all of these pieces and works, they've lasted 400 years, 300 years, 200 years, whatever it is. When you see pop music just like coming and going and only a handful lasting maybe 5-10 years, mm-hmm. there's a reverence to this music, to the notes. Yes. Like, do you ever feel like it could ever be matched by anything that's being created today opera-wise? Let's talk about, you know, 21st century operas. Like, whenever I see a 21st century opera, I'm always like, man, it's just never like the old stuff. The old stuff is so good. Like, I'm way into Italian operas. Donizetti, Puccini is my man. Puccini, yes. Like, honestly, Puccini, I could just listen to Puccini and nothing but, because it's just so well done. Mm-hmm. There's so much good opera, Mozart. There's so much great stuff. So how do you feel when you, I'm sure there, that's part of the gig, is like you're going to have to do some modern stuff every now and then. How do you feel like that relates to some of the older stuff?
You know, it's so funny. In this career, some people kind of go the new music route and they kind of get into that little world. Right. I've done some new music. I've done John Adams. Wow. I've done Penderecki, things like that. But I always was really in the very standard repertoire, Wagner, Verdi, Puccini.
Yes. Ooh. That's all the good stuff right there.
And I'm really grateful because I've had to, you know, put together some, you know, new music concerts and recitals. And some of it has been beautiful. Actually, a composer that was still a theory professor at Cal State Fullerton, she wrote this song cycle and I debuted it on this new music festival a couple of years ago. And it's gorgeous. But I did have to completely think about the way that I sang, and certain things as an opera singer just doesn't work.
Right.
You have to add to, you know, rethink what is straight tone? How do I implement straight tone? How do I maintain tessitura that this piece demands, you know? So when it comes to modern pieces, it's funny you should ask that, you know, the Met is kind of going in this direction. I don't know if you've seen articles about
this.
Yes.
But which I hate, by the way, from between you and I. It's like, I love the old, just stick with the old stuff. It's so good.
I think, I mean, Nikki, you're right. And, you know, what I am concerned for, and I sound like an old woman saying, I'm so worried, but ultimately the old stuff is, as you said, it's here and it maintains and it survives for a reason, but also they knew how to write for voices, right? They had the ability to write for the instrument that they were composing for. Right. And they had singers that debuted roles, or they would say, you know what, that's not working for me. That's too loud there, or that brass is too loud there, or that whatever. But I never feel, even in the loudest Verdi, unless you're pushing, or the loudest Wagner, which I've done like a million Wagner productions at this point, you don't get into vocal trouble because they know. They had singers and they understood the instrument.
Right.
But I find with a lot of these new pieces, they're starting to use a lot of amplification in opera.
Wow.
And I have been in sessions, like I was the LA Phil this summer. You went to with LA Phil. And it was all amplified because that's how that space works. And that's how the whole projection and projections were set up. But it does something to the human voice that is not inherently what this art form is was created for.
Absolutely.
It distorts what we do, which is this coordination of the body and the instrument and resonance and vowels. And you're able to kind of do this magic and send this voice out without amplification in a space. That's what people respond to. It's not the piece isn't interesting or the story isn't interesting. It's the actual sound that a human voice emits.
Right.
But when you start messing with things and you start changing acoustics and you start using soundboards and mics to completely alter orchestration.
Or the music, sometimes the modern music is, they're trying to make the voice something it's not. Like,
that's
annoying.
I think the voice, they want singers to serve them and they are not serving the singer. The singer should dictate what the thing is. And I find that we are saying whatever you want. And a lot of these individuals, while they have good ideas, they're not steeped in this. They're like, I just feel like writing an opera. Like, so I'm just going to do that.
Right.
But that's not it really.
Yes.
That's like somebody that says, you know what? I feel like singing some opera. I'm just going to go sing some opera now. And I want to do it. So I should be able to do it.
I'm going to just be an interior designer today. And I'm just going to go into your house and just change everything the way I think it should be changed.
That's it.
That's not really the same. It's not.
It takes a lifetime to understand something that is this great, whether it's fine art, whether it's, classical music, whether it's theater,
Well, you also know, and you know this too, it's like there's an art versus commerce thing.
Yes.
Always fighting against itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have people in the opera world, I know that you've dealt with this, where they're, like my parents used to have season tickets to the LA Opera and they would go see old productions of operas they loved. And they would tell me that they would modernize these productions to the point where it was like, what are you doing? You're changing the entire story and the time period to make it modernized, and it doesn't resonate or work because people don't go to see that story in a modern setting. They go to see the old school story in the old school setting, and we just count on you having good singers. That's all that matters. That's all you need.
But you just said something. We just count on you having good singers.
Yeah.
But if our priorities are not good singing, which we're getting a little confused now.
Yes, yes.
We run the risk of alienating whatever audience we have left because we're trying to change inherently what it is that we do to make it Instagram worthy.
Right.
Oh, likes,
yeah, hearts, it's great.
Comments. The people that comment and like and hearts, they do not go to the opera.
Right, right. And it's weird that those metrics are dictating art on any sphere.
That's it.
And then you go, I'm sure do you still go to Europe and perform?
I haven't been to Europe since before the pandemic, but
when you go into an opera house or you go into a concert house, there's a reverence for the work that you just don't see here in the same way. And it would be preposterous to do any of these things with that music over there. They're like, it's steeped in tradition. It's steeped in those values. Let it just be what it is. And the tradition and history will prevail and keep carrying this forward. And for some reason, I don't know if it's because a lot of opera didn't start here, but I think they're just trying to make it like musical theater, and it's like they're trying to modernize it or make it hip, but it's a little annoying because really what you and I both love about opera is how classic it is. And like it is a time capsule of a period that we weren't around for, but my God, this music outlived so many centuries of what has happened, in world history, but the art has stayed the same and still resonates because you have these librettos or these, these composers making this art that was really like the very first cinema. They're amazing stories, amazing, real estate of language and music. And the art is so profound that people forget that it's just enough. It's just enough to have the music and the singers and the orchestra just perform what it is. So I'm sure your industry battles the same kind of modernizations that my industry battles.
Yes.
But how do you feel do you think that opera is changing in how its attitude is towards performers and orchestras, and are unions kind of fighting for that world a little bit, or is it kind of like it's still uncharted territory and it's still finding its place?
I am concerned for the direction that things are going, because I find that we're losing the identity, as you were saying. There's almost like an embarrassment, that, like almost like we're embarrassed as a country of this art form, right, so that we have to change it because we're embarrassed by what it is. And I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Right.
It's very troubling. And those of us that really do it at a very high level, and those of us that are connoisseurs, that you studied it, you deeply understand it. It's troubling. I never saw this coming, and I don't understand where that's going to take us, you know?
It's definitely territory. Go ahead.
Opera's not, just because, like I was saying before, just because you want to do something, just because you feel that you should have opportunities or you should be able to do something just because you want to do it, doesn't mean that you can. Yes. The entry, the bar should be so high to entry because of what it takes as an athletic endeavor and skill that you put together over a decade, two decades. So I feel like the barrier to entry is starting to become somewhere like
compromise. Yeah. Yes.
Because I'm not sure what, I don't know what that is, but right, it's the same thing as like, please like us. Do you like this? Does this make you happy? Like our Instagram page? Like, is this sexy to you? Is this?
And the irony is like, you have all these opera houses that are like historical gems all over the world. Mm-hmm. Like all the places that you perform, this, they're just celebrated. They're celebrated works. They're amazing, you know, buildings and concert halls. And, you know, like the Metropolitan is a well-crafted, designed auditorium, you know, performance hall. Do you feel like that changes from, you know, kind of venue to venue? Or do you feel like in some venues it's preserved, in some countries it may be more preserved than others? Like, how does that change from country to country for each venue?
I think it's much more preserved in Europe. I wouldn't say this, like productions, they can be a little crazy. They're state funded, so they're willing to try Planet of the Apes as Trovatore Planet of the Apes. You know, they're willing to kind of go off the rails, right, for someone's concept. But I think in the States, I'm starting to be more inspired by smaller opera companies than I am by some of the larger ones at the moment. I feel like there's a little bit more flexibility with these smaller companies to also hire great singers, because things are getting smaller, seasons are getting smaller, they're cutting, you know, performances and repertoire. So a lot of really great singers that wouldn't necessarily sing at some of these houses in the past are starting to, because they're available. And so they're getting great talent, and they have the flexibility to kind of pivot and try really interesting things. And they're not trapped by a season that they've already invested, you know, however many millions of dollars.
You've sung in so many amazing halls and places. Do you have any favorites? Like, are there some that when you walk in, you still feel that same energy as the first time? Give me some of those that you love.
I mean, the Met is amazing to sing in because it really is acoustically meant for singing. I mean, it's really one of the great acoustic spaces for the human voice. As long as you don't, you know, notice the 4,000 seats, you know, and the giant orchestra pit, you know, you have to kind of ignore everything and just say, this is a small little space, and I'm just making sound in a small space. I think Boston, you know, Symphony Hall, always, every time I get a chance to sing there, it's just beautiful, but also it's very live. So you're constantly getting feedback in a physical way, which I love. In terms of other venues that I think are fantastic.
Well, you just did the Hollywood Bowl. That's a pretty epic.
The Hollywood Bowl is interesting. I mean, it's exciting to be there, but it's scary because you get zero back.
Right.
And it's a scary open space. And, you know, that to me, and especially because you're using mics, it's a different experience. It's actually
a different beast. Yeah.
It's a strange experience. I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, granted, oh, I have performed in Disney Hall before. That's a great space too.
Oh yeah, that's totally built for acoustics.
Great space. San Francisco Opera, also the War Memorial, one of the best houses to sing in.
What about in Europe? Have you done like anything like Berlin, Staatsoper?
I haven't sung in Berlin, but I have sung in Italy. I've sung in Sicily at the Teatro Massimo.
Oh, amazing
space, gorgeous. I've sung a lot in Japan, in Tokyo, awesome. And I'm in Taiwan, in Hong Kong. Amazing concert halls there.
And are you doing a lot of the same roles, or are you kind of doing different?
I was doing a lot of the same roles throughout my late 20s into, you know, through like mid 30s. I'm starting now to kind of move into, you know, I was really in German land for a long time.
Right.
I'm starting to kind of go back into, while keeping firmly some German rep, I'm doing the Dallas Ring next year, but I'm really starting to get back into the Italian world.
I love it.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot more Italian this season and next season than I have in.
What are you doing in the Italian opera world this season?
I am doing I have something next week, and I'm doing the Verdi Requiem in Boston.
That's awesome.
Which is going to be
a great piece.
Amazing piece. What other Italian rep? I'm doing Rigoletto in New York.
Oh, that's awesome.
May, in concert, two performances of that. I'm doing. I'm trying to think. I'm doing a recital. I'm doing some Mozart, which is not Italian, but Mozart.
You know, he counts. He's that good.
Italian premiere. We're doing it actually this modern piece, speaking of modern pieces, but with the Boston Symphony, we're doing this world premiere of an Italian composer. So in June. So that's going to be great too. Some really exciting things in the.
And it's also like, you know, and you know this, like, you know, when you sing with different conductors, it's always a different experience. When you sing with different singers and ensembles, it's always a different experience. Do you ever find that there's one ensemble or a conductor that you just always feel like there's like something, there's good juju, there's a good vibe with a certain opera company or a certain, or is it always different and that's what makes it exciting for you?
I would say it's always different. I have a lot of respect for Andres Nelsons, who's the head of the Boston Symphony. He loves singers. So when you have a conductor that loves singers, that's like the game changer, you know?
Right.
Sometimes I don't necessarily think that conductors love singers all that much, which is an interesting experience. I just worked with an Italian conductor in Palm Beach Opera in January. We did the Butterfly production. His dad was a singer.
Okay.
And you could tell, he just loves the voice. He loves the voice. So he understands how to keep the orchestra down. You know, at moments when it gets really loud, he doesn't cover the singers, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's conductors like that that understand, again, it's like they intimately understand this.
Right.
And I think like that's the whole point of this whole thing. When you have people that don't really care or respect this, we have a problem.
Right, right. Well, and also he's Italian. So Italians love singers, like just in the country, you know, it's like, yeah. There was a point where I was like so into opera, and I was like, you know what? I would just live in Italy. I just don't even care if I would live in the U.S. because it's like there's a different. It's like an Olympic sport over there.
It is.
Like, I mean, you'll see restaurants where, you know, the chefs will be singing in the back because they. I mean, it's just like part of the culture in a way that it's not anywhere else. And so, like, I'm obsessed with Italy for that reason. Are there roles that you find that you gravitate towards more, that you just find there's either a little bit more meat in the roles or like there's a certain aria that resonates with you? What are the pieces or what are the roles that you really truly love to sing the most?
I mean, I really love singing the Wagner repertoire, Kundry, which is from Parsifal, an amazing character, dramatic with it, but still beautiful.
Right.
But I'm really starting to understand, which I didn't get when I was younger, the Verdi repertoire, how he wrote for the voice like I've never even experienced.
Yeah.
And if you do it faithfully, you will love it forever because it doesn't take you to your extremes. It's the perfectly written for the voice. So, you know, as I kind of age into all that repertoire, which I am now, you know, Amneris and Aida, Azucena in Trovatore, like the kind of, very complicated.
Oh, it's heavy. You know, heavy music.
It's that kind of music, but you have to be a certain age and you have to have maturity to be able to sing the repertoire and not emotionally, physically allow yourself to get too carried away. You have to kind of almost be like, I'm cool inside. I don't feel anything, but the music's so emotional so that you don't get distracted by what's going on.
The very first opera I did was Othello, Verdi, with Placido Domingo. And I think I was like, I must have been like 11. And it was just such heavy music from the very first note to the very end. And it was also a long opera. So you just know Verdi is serious business. For me, it's like, it's Verdi, Puccini, Donizetti, and then Mozart. That's like, those are the four. It's like, I can just listen to that all day and that could be it. And I would be completely content because of the stories that they're also telling with the music, you know. Yes. You know, but I also love Wagner. I love Brahms too. There's so many. Beethoven. I mean, you can't scoff at any of those guys. Yeah. Let's play something else. What are we going to play next?
The next selection is Rachmaninoff's Soldier's Wife. It's an art song. It's gorgeous.
Right. Here's where you played him with Rachmaninoff. Beautiful. Renee, you got a killer voice. Woo! Awesome. Tell me what it's like, you know, the difference between singing with an orchestra and singing that intimately with just an accompanist.
I used to hate recitals when I was younger because they're so exposed. I think we all were trained to hate them. I just think they're punishing. I mean, especially when you're getting your voice together, your technique, I mean, there's always this, you're just trying to get through it. That's how I always looked at it. And then, you know, as I've gotten older, they're one of the great joys because you get to choose a repertoire. You don't have a voice teacher saying, well, you have to check all these boxes,
yes,
you know? Yeah. So, and then you can just start exploring being an artist. I think that you were able to do that in a way that, you know, opera doesn't always allow, you know, it's less intimate. So yeah.
It's awesome. Well, you know what, where can people find you if they want to hire you for opera companies, they want to see you perform? Where can people find you?
So my management is L2 Artists, and you can find them at L2Artists.com. I think there's a link on my website, which is www.reneetatum.com.
Spell it out because people are dumb, Renee.
www.reneetatum.com. And you'll be able to find my current bio, just a short bio, but also my schedule for the 22-23 season and contact information as well.
We need to get you out to LA Opera because I got to take Bonnie to an opera. So
yes,
you got to be there in LA Opera and I will bring Bonnie to see her.
I have this nostalgia. I miss California. Phil does too. You know, I just think, oh my gosh, I want to come back.
Well, bring Parker too, your new arrival. Yes. Well, I need to meet the boy.
Yes.
And bring that other guy, Phil, too. We'll have him around too as well.
We'll keep him.
Well, Renee, thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We have an open window for you to keep coming back every time you have performances. We want to just keep showcasing your talent. You're a wonderful person, wonderful talent. And thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We'll see you next time. And I have to see you soon and just give you guys hugs because I miss you all. California misses you. When we miss you too, okay?
Sounds great, Nikki. Thanks so much.
On behalf of Sam, myself, and Renee, we'll see you guys next week. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.